Hello, it's Saturday. Well, let me start more at the traditional beginning. It's Mike. It's The Gist. The specific mic in question is Pesca, and it's Saturday, and that means it's the Saturday show. And today, as we do each week on the Saturday show, we bring you one from the vault and one from the week, and this time, the one from the week will inform the one from the vaults. So I interviewed a few years ago a guy I've known since we were young kids, a guy named Craig Rothfeld, who went on to the burgeoning field of prison consultant. And in fact, he was Harvey Weinstein's prison consultant. And why is Harvey Weinstein in the news? Because the New York Court of Appeals ordered him, if not released, because he's still in prison because of his crimes in California, but ordered that he is entitled to a new trial. And the Manhattan DA says they will try everything in their power to grant him that, to subject him to that. What wouldn't be in their power? Maybe if the witnesses won't come forward, the entire basis of the appeal was these prior acts witnesses, these Molyneux witnesses, which we'll get into on the segment that I aired this week. So that is the one from the vault. That is the one from the week. It's all Harvey Weinstein. I even talked about this yesterday on the show. If you want to hear my comments on the New York Times reporting and one of the two main reporters from the She Said movie and book, and the Times reporting, they really broke this story wide open, how they're framing the latest developments. It's also very fascinating. It's not the only fascinating legal development / entanglement, but it's one I'm focusing on. And won't you come and join me? So you've heard me say, perhaps in an ad in the recent past, that first we make our habits, then they make us. That is a quote attributed to the English poet John Dryden. I believe he was the first poet laureate. It is poetic. First we make our habits, then they make us. Let's talk about the inverse of that. What do we do when we want to get rid of a habit? What about when we think our habits are, let us say, unmaking us? Enter a product I'm here to talk to you about. It's called Fume. Fume is not a vapor. It's flavored air. So what it does is it takes one habit that maybe you're trying to kick and replace it with a behavior that has the look and feel of that habit, but not the detriments. It's pleasant. It's similar. It's replacing a bad habit with a different, more positive behavior. And now, with all orders, you could buy one, get one on their cores, which are their different flavorings. You could stock up throughout the year, these cold winter months, something to do, something to exhale, flavored air, so nice. And as a listener of The Gist, you'll get an extra 10% off when you use the code. Head to tryfume.com/thegist and use the code THEGIST for an additional 10% off, plus BOGO cores to help start making the good habit that much easier. Thank you, Shaka Smart. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Craig Rothfeld is an interesting guy with an interesting background who does a very interesting thing now. He is the proprietor of Inside Outside LTD. What that company is essentially a prison consultant. If someone is going to a prison or jail and they want to know what to expect, they ask Craig. And the reason Craig knows is, well, he's been there too. We should also disclose, I've known Craig since we were about 8 and played on the same soccer team. Hey, how you doing, Craig?
Michael, here we are.
Here we are.
Good. I'm great. Yeah. Two guys from Oceanside, Long Island. Thank you.
Okay. So, Craig, I know a little bit of this. Tell me how you got a firsthand glance at what prison and the realities of prison was like.
Yeah. I mean, cut me off when you need to. I mean, the arc started really back in 2002 when I made a decision after 9/11 not to go into investment banking. And someone else you know from our days in Oceanside High School, Mike Romano, and his father-in-law, Dina Bonfanti's dad, they owned a $2 brokerage firm on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And I had started consulting for them and helped arrange a financing so they could buy a seat. Through the course of that, very short and sweet, they asked me to come build the firm. And Mike and I built a firm from 2002 to 2012. We did some incredible things. Our peak had 120 employees, 46 million in revenues, 5 regional offices. But after the financial crisis hit, we were faced with a lot of decisions, and they are decisions that I wish I had made differently. I'm very careful to say they weren't mistakes. These were choices. These were bad, horrible choices, bad decisions. We had other options, and unfortunately, I falsified financial statements to keep the business open. We ran personal expenses through our business just to save on the amount of taxes that we would pay. Mm-hmm. And it was the wrong thing to do. Ultimately, we lost the business. We shut down January 1, 2012. I was barred from the industry. I thought it was all over. I started to rebuild my life. And in February 2014, 26 months later, I got a bang on the door, and it was the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to arrest me and indict me. That ultimately led to 22 months of defending myself, and I ultimately took a plea.
Yes.
It's an indeterminate sentence, or in street talk, a split bid. I got sentenced to 1.5 to 4.5 years in New York State prison.
And according to this record I have, it says you pled guilty in New York State Supreme Court to various charges, including grand larceny, securities fraud, and tax crimes.
That would all be accurate. And as a result of that, on December 15th, 2015, I started my sentence in the New York City Department of Corrections, and ultimately the lion's share of it in the New York State Department of Corrections.
Do you know, I mean, as you look back, or have you found out, between being barred by the securities industry, so a punishment, but not a criminal punishment, not taking away your freedom, between that and the charges, what changed? Why did they, were they working on it the whole time, or was a decision made to charge you criminally? Do you know why that decision was made?
Yeah, I mean, I to the extent that it's been explained to me by my former criminal attorney, Mark Ignifilo, who's now a dear friend and business colleague, ultimately, and I don't want to minimize this, Mike, I think what had happened is I was arrogant in trying to save the business the last year or two. I pissed a lot of people off at FINRA. And I think, ultimately I signed what's called an admission waiver and consent. I think they took it. They mailed it down to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And there are a lot of former FINRA employees that are at the DA's office, former DA, ADAs that are at FINRA. And they indicted me because they could. And because the reality is, Mike, I broke the law. I signed a financial statement, submitted it to FINRA and the SEC, and it was false. So when you do that, there can be a punishment. So I accept that.
FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. So there you are, you're facing prison time. And when you take the plea, it is expressed to you, you will be serving time in prison. What is your conception of what might lie ahead?
I spent the 22 months prior to going in preparing myself in a way I had never prepared myself for anything in life. I mean, as hard as I ever studied in high school or college or to pass the CPA exam or to get through grad school and get an MBA or pass any professional licensing, I studied the Department of Corrections and what would or could happen to me in a way that I had never studied anything before. And the reason, and to answer your question, is, you know, this is state prison. I was not going to a camp. So I knew that I was going to do quote unquote hard time. I knew I was going to be in Rikers Island for a period of time. And so once I took a plea, I knew that I was going to prison, but I had already been spending 17 months getting ready to go.
What resources were out there?
Well, the Department of Corrections website is a resource, public, so it's nothing fancy, but most people don't read it. And, you know, if you drill down, you'll find hundreds of information memos. You find information about programming. Columbia University, Westlaw, LexisNexis have lots of articles, studies, information resources on the Department of Corrections. And then I thought, who better to talk to than former inmates and retired corrections officers? But, you know, those are the resources, Mike.
How'd you convince former prisoners or former prison officials and guards to talk to you?
Maybe it'll surprise you, maybe not. It's a rite of passage. This is a fraternity that nobody wants to be in, but once you're in it, you're all in it together. And there is the ultimate pay it forward for people that have gone through the experience. The term we all use is we were fellow travelers. You know, when we go away, we call it, you know, I was away on vacation, obviously anything but that, but people are very willing to talk to you.
Is that the bulk of the people you were talking to? Not people who were there for violent crimes, not people who, and they would have been in your same prison. They could have been in your same prison, but you were talking to other people essentially who were there for white collar crimes.
Both. Yeah. I spoke to people obviously who were there for white collar crimes for obvious reasons and to understand how I might navigate the system and how you navigate it as a 5'6", you know, Long Island Jewish mama's boy. But I also, because of where I work, you know, at the time I was working up in Harlem and people I knew, I got to people who, you know, went in for violent felonies as well. I wanted to talk to people of all sorts of flavors because I needed the total 360 perspective.
So there are two idioms. One is you could do all the war planning you want until the first bullets fly. And the way Mike Tyson said it was you could do all the preparation you want until you get punched in the mouth. So you do all this work and then you get into prison. And what helped you and what didn't comport with the research that you did from the comfort of your chair?
I was very well prepared, Mike. People really that I talked to did a good job of explaining things and taking the mystery away of different things. What it was going to be like to get on a bus in leg shackles. What it was going to be like to go to Rikers. What it was going to be like to leave Rikers and go to a reception facility, which was Ulster. What that bus ride felt like. What it was going to be like, you know, to get de-liced and do the shower. So I think the punch in the face wasn't so much the actual things that happened. I think it's the emotions. In my case, it's the emotional punch in the face. It's that first night in Rikers, in the tombs, the day I was sentenced. How the bleep did I get here?
Right. This is the Manhattan holding facility in Lower Manhattan, the tombs.
Yeah, the Manhattan Detention Center, affectionately known as the tombs.
Then as you go through it, how long are you in Rikers?
Without fail, Mike, everyone wants to know about Rikers. And I got the luxury of spending 5.5 weeks there when you should only spend 10 days. And, you know, this is a little nugget, which I'll give away. And I talk to my clients about. Ordinarily, New York State law requires that they take possession of you within 10 days of sentencing. Mm-hmm. So what actually happens is when you're sentenced, you now are the custody of New York State. They literally own you. And New York City Department of Corrections, which consists of the tombs and Rikers and a few other jails, hold you as a courtesy to New York State to come pick you up. And you're supposed to be picked up within 10 business days. However, oftentimes what happens is your paperwork, it's called your commitment papers, are missing a signature or a checkbox. We can speculate as to whether or not the judge's clerks innocently miss it or they do it on purpose because they want a you-know-what with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in with my co-defendant, and 10 days later, they picked him up to take him upstate, and I found out the next day that the judge's clerk did not sign my commitment papers. So as a result of that, I wasn't what's called state-ready. So I wound up staying in Rikers for basically an extra 4 weeks, and it was 5.5 weeks of pure fascination and many other things.
Did your preparation make you handle that? I mean, you were preparing for 10 days. You're there five times as long.
Yes. But after a while, you know, I had two or three, you know, thankfully kept to myself, major emotional breakdowns. I mean, Rikers Island is you know, to say it's a scary place, Mike, is not to do it justice. And I'm not one to be grandiose or embellish, but whatever anyone thinks about it, it's a million times worse. It's horrific. I don't know that anything anyone else did prepared me for Rikers. I just believe my own mental fortitude and the fact that I never looked down on people ever. Mm-hmm. And I knew how to keep to myself kind of worked in my favor. And if you want, I'll share just a brief anecdote with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I walked into a dorm at Rikers as a day room. It's like in a, you know, bubble with chairs and a television. And then it's just a big rectangular room with 60 beds, 20 along the left wall, 20 down the middle, 20 along the right wall, 60 max. I walked in, there were 42 Bloods, you know, affectionately of the Bloods and the Crip street gangs.
Yeah.
So here I am, one of four Caucasian white men in there. And you have to assess the situation, you know, rather quickly. And at first, I found out 10 days later, they thought I was an undercover cop. But they found
out. Does that make you more safe or less safe, do you think?
Less safe, much less safe.
Yeah.
So they have their ways to find out that you're actually a criminal, and then they kind of ease up on you. And what ultimately happened was I kept to myself. I stayed on my bed. I was very cordial to people. Sadly, and I mean this, people can't read or write in there. And what wound up happening is people started coming to me. I was writing letters. I was reading people's medical papers, and that endeared me to them. And the reality is they didn't want anything to happen to me. You know, being Jewish, it would be a hate crime if something happened to me. And so I was protected in a way. They kept me out of harm's way, and I read my books, and I helped people. And I was fortunate, and I just, you know, I knew enough to never use my education as a weapon. And, you know, I was raised by good grandparents.
When you finally got out, where do you spend the rest of your time?
So a couple of places. In New York State, there's five reception facilities, and there's four other facilities that are like pre-reception facilities. But you have to go to one of the five of them, or one of the four intake facilities, in order to get what's called a permanent facility. So Ulster is a medium security facility. Downstate is a maximum security facility. I went to Ulster because I was medium security. I spent 8 weeks there. From there, I went and was put permanently, quote unquote, in Ogdensburg Correctional Facility up in St. Lawrence County. I was an eighth of a mile from the Canadian border. I was able to see the Canadian flag walking around the track. Over an 8-hour drive from the city. I got to Ogdensburg in the middle of March, and I spent about five and three quarter months at Ogdensburg, and was very fortunate to be admitted to a temporary release program, the first of two. I did a work release program. I came back down to Hudson, New York, spent time at Hudson Correctional Facility, and we work for Corecraft. Corecraft's owned by the Department of Corrections. They make all the furniture, the soaps, the uniform, shoes, and everything.
Weren't they the ones making the hand sanitizer?
Yeah, they were. So Corecraft, there's multiple layers to Corecraft, but in the maximum security facilities, a lot of the stuff that Corecraft sells to the different prisons and not-for-profits around the state is made there.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just interrupt. There was some sort of backlash. Oh, it's prisoner-made Purell. But from what I glean, you appreciated the opportunity to have something like that to do.
Oh, it was like hitting prison lotto. You know, no question about it. And that's the reality of it, is it was prison lotto.
Oh, God. Just talk about the sociology. I mean, a lot of us have read a lot or watched a lot of movies. Some of them seem accurate about the hierarchies in prison and the structure and the sociology of prison. How much of that is true and how much of the reality differs from, you know, what we might have seen in an HBO show or Oz or the Shawshank Redemption?
Yeah, Shawshank I've seen multiple times.
Do they play that in prison?
You know what? Let me think about that. Yes, they do. Yeah. Actually, some of the favorite shows in, this is so worth laughing about. Two of the most popular shows in prison, Criminal Minds and Law and Order. I mean, I didn't watch it, but it's just like, you know, you committed, it's like as if they can learn how to commit a better crime, but fascinating. Yeah, the hierarchies exist. There's no question about it. Even if you're in a medium security prison, you're doing time with people who served in maximum security prisons, because the way the Department of Corrections works is that they move maximum people down to mediums after they serve, you know, a percentage or significant portion of their sentence. So I was in a medium security prison with a guy who was in for murder too. The ultimate respect goes to older men, OGs they call them. If you're 60 and up, you know, you're one kind of protected class, unless you're just a total jerk. people who served in maximum security prisons and have done, you know, 15 or more years have a complete level of respect. You're aware of people that are in for guns and or more violent crimes. You know, the gangs are in there. The Latin Kings are in there. The Bloods are in there. The Crips are in there. So there's a real social order to prison. There is a hierarchy to prison. And this is just among the inmates. Forget the corrections officers.
And do you try not to associate with the Latin Kings or the Bloods, or is there no way to avoid that?
It's impossible to avoid it when you're living in a dorm with people. I interacted with everyone. First of all, no matter what you say, that was my world. That was my ecosystem. And I always say to people, yeah, no one wants to be in prison. It's the worst place in the world to be besides 6 feet under. But there's good and bad in prison. You know, it's life. It's the natural order thing to develop relationships with people. You're living in tight quarters. And the number one source of information, more than research, information memos, the greatest source of information for me that I use in my practice was the interviews and conversations I had with former inmates, their life stories, their prison stories. And for them, I was, you know, I'm not a genius, Mike, but I was, you know, an educated man who they viewed as a wealth of information for them. So it was, you spent time talking to each other.
Can you recall where any instance where your knowledge or your skills tangibly helped an inmate either in an appeal or just, I don't know, getting through the day?
Absolutely. The most basic was people who didn't know how to read. There were people there who didn't know how to read. And so I'd either read letters. I would often review their legal papers for them, explain what it all meant. I wrote letters for people. I typed letters for people. I am not fluent in Spanish, but I'm conversant, so I was able to help with Spanish to English situations when necessary. And I did. I helped somebody prepare a writ of habeas corpus to try to get their entire sentence and conviction thrown out. It ran the gamut. Everyone has kind of nicknames in prison.
Yeah.
I had two. One was the rabbi, because I'm Jewish. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of guys called me Google because they thought I had all these answers. Now, I don't have all the answers, but I had a lot more than most people in there. So, and that was every way through. I did that at Rikers. I did that at Ulster. And I did that at Ogdensburg. But I was able to help people.
When you went from facility to facility, did you ever come into a situation where there was someone else you had served with, and so your reputation was known when you got there?
Yeah, that's interesting that you brought that up. One of the gentlemen that I had become close with at Ulster during that 8-week reception stint wound up coming to Hudson after I had been at Hudson for 3 months. And then someone I had served time with at Ogdensburg wound up coming down to Hudson after I was there. So that was interesting. And then the last 7 weeks, I served at Lincoln Correctional Facility, which has since been shut down on 110th Street.
Uh-huh.
And when I got there, it was sort of a reunion of people you met at all the different facilities throughout.
When does your experience become, in your mind, maybe I could do this for other people, maybe I could make a business out of this?
When I was in prison. Mm-hmm. I knew once I got into prison that it was something that I could do. I had a prison consultant myself who was not a New York State specialist. He's one of the foremost federal specialists in the country. He's a career criminologist, very, very well respected. A gentleman by the name of Joel Sickler, who runs Justice Advocacy Group, someone that I love, is near and dear to me. So I knew what he was doing. And once I got in, it was clear to me that this is something that I can do. And we collaborate to this day. I handle most of Joel's New York State work, and I refer all my federal work to him, and he's an incredible guy. But once I was in, it was obvious to me that I could do something with it. And then when I got out, it was really a combination of Joel and my attorneys. My attorney, Mark Ignifilo, sat me down and he said, you need to do this. That's it. You must do this. There is a void. There is a space. It's very complimentary of me. And you know, he said, you're the one who needs to do this. And, you know, I started doing it. I was doing it for a little over 2.5 years professionally. And then I had the 40 months of, you know, time inside in the 22 months fighting. So it's a long run. You know, I don't know how many years is that, Mike? It's a little over 6 years, almost 7 years.
How did this part of your career play out? How did you even first hear that Harvey Weinstein might be in need of your services?
Great story. And it's a story that applies to all of us, all walks of life, totally steeped in you never know who knows who. Always treat people the right way. you know, on your way up, on your way down. I had been retained by a client who was already at Ulster Correctional Facility, the reception center. You know, I can get retained at all different various points, which we can get to later. Mm-hmm. And I was retained by the client. And that client, on his bus ride from Rikers to Ulster, was shackled to another gentleman. So they had an instant bond. And 3 days later, that gentleman hired me. So the client that I got came through my attorney, which is a natural source of referrals. The other person, I had no idea who he was, and I got referred by another inmate. And that person's attorney happened to be Arthur Idala. And Arthur and I developed a relationship because I needed him for the parole report. I stayed in touch with him as I built my practice.
Yeah.
And what had happened was, as they were winding down closing arguments in the Weinstein case, I had just gotten my third person approved for parole. So I sent an email out to all the criminal attorneys that kind of on my listserv list explaining what had happened and different things they should consider for their current clients. And Arthur responded to me in an email and said, I'm sure you know I'm on the Weinstein case. Call me tomorrow at 3 p.m. You know, we need you.
So in a way, it's a classic case of it's not what you know, it's who you're shackled to.
And yeah, I like that. It's who you're shackled to. Absolutely. But it just goes to show you, Mike, right? That line works even in prison.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Your clients up to this point, had they mostly done, all done financial crimes? Because Weinstein's a rapist. I mean, is that crime different from the crimes of most of your clients up to that point?
Yes, it is. And a lot goes into when you make the decision to retain someone. But most of the clients that I had and the crimes that they were convicted of were either white collar, nonviolent crimes. Some were alcohol related crimes, you know, DWIs and DUIs. But this was the first time I was retained by someone who, if convicted and if they went in, was going in for what would ultimately be a violent crime.
Tell me about the ethical considerations, if any, that went into accepting Weinstein as a client.
A lot did. You know, there's no particular order to this, but, you know, I protect their privacy a lot, but I have two young daughters and I talked with them for obvious reasons. Spoke with my spouse. This potentially had implications for the whole family. And I spoke to a lot of friends, professional colleagues on a horizontal level and, mm-hmm. and mentors about what it all meant and what it would mean to accept it, what it would mean in people's eyes, so on and so forth. And surprisingly, almost everyone came down in the same way, which is that if you want to do this for a career, you don't get to choose necessarily. A lot of people pointed out to me that public defenders who are admired by everyone are representing, you know, murderers. Mm-hmm. And no one's taking their inventory. You know, he's not my friend, right? I didn't know him at that point. It's not family. The biggest reason I had originally got into this, Mike, was for the families. I mean, the families do the time right along with you. I mean, I'd argue sometimes it's harder on the families than it is on the inmate. And, you know, someone very close to me said, Harvey's got a family. He's got children. He's got ex-wives. He's got a family too. And they're innocent victims. And the family deserves this as much as any other family. And that really resonated with me. And then, look, if I wanted to do this, you don't say no professionally, at least in my opinion. I mean, being invited to arguably the biggest dance, they don't often happen. It may never happen again. And,
right.
You know, I'm very candid about it. So I think I put all those inputs together and I made the decision to do it.
I would also think that, A, it just helps to be agnostic as far as you could be on the crimes that were committed. And sometimes maybe, you know, there is a phenomenon of false conviction. Doubtful that that happened in the Weinstein case. But it just helps, I would think, to do what you do, to be really not judgmental about the actual crimes. And the second point would be, if you think what you're doing is a good thing, not only for yourself, but your clients, having Weinstein as a client is very helpful to the business. It lets other people know what you're doing. You got a lot of press, like, say, being interviewed on The Gist. So I would think those two things would add up to taking him on as a client, and the considerations of if he is or isn't a horrible man is not something to totally discount, but perhaps outweighed by the other two considerations.
I agree. Someone said to me, look, this is your business. You're putting food on the table for your family. I mean, the two things I would tell you in regards to who I spoke to is, you know, I met with my rabbi.
Yeah.
And we had a long, hard talk about it. And, you know, we talked about it in terms of just being friends. I talked about it in terms of him being a rabbi. I talked about it in terms of the Talmud. I mean, what it means and whether people deserve second chances. And I also spoke with Rabbi Moshe Frank, who is the rabbi for Eastern Correctional Facility, which is a maximum security prison, and Ulster. I had spent 8 weeks twice a week with Rabbi Frank, and he's still a dear friend, and he works for the Department of Corrections. And I also spoke with Dan Court. Dan might be someone you know. Dan is, you know, New York State Assemblyman. He's running for District Attorney of Manhattan. He's someone that I support. He's a great guy. And I'm doing a lot of work for him. And, you know, I talked to Dan about it just from a legal standpoint and what it is to be an attorney. And it's not about taking inventory of the crimes. It's not about making it personal. It's also about the fact that once you're convicted and you go to prison, doesn't everybody deserve a second chance? I mean, isn't forgiveness one of the bedrocks of what we're all about and what humanity should be about? So a lot went into it, Mike. It wasn't a flippant decision.
Or if you think the prison system is in some ways unjust or horrible, the justice should be confinement, right? The justice isn't, as articulated in the law, it isn't, oh, you'll have these deprivations visited upon you, or, you know, maybe you'll be actually, someone will be violent with you, right? That's not justice. So if you could help someone avoid that, you're not perpetuating an injustice. You're actually, in a way, perpetuating justice.
Yes, that's right. New York State Department of Corrections, the facilities, and this is not about the people who work there. They're very fine people who work in the Department of Corrections. They're horrible. You know, these are old prisons run on budget and government funding. You know, it really is. It's my line that people hear a lot. It's a Byzantine black hole.
Do you have any like non-disclosure or things you can't say about talking with Weinstein?
I do. All questions can be asked, and if I can't answer, I won't answer. But I do have a non-disclosure. I am also one of the authorized healthcare proxies for him as part of the legal defense team. So, you know, there are certain things I can't answer, but yeah. I'm happy to answer, you know, what I can.
So how is he different? You take away who he is, his notoriety, and what he did. How is he different from the other 20 clients you've had?
He's Harvey Weinstein. I mean, right. That's the first thing. I mean, he's the most famous client I had. Well, first of all, he has more pre-existing medical conditions than any other client I have. He's the oldest client I have by a long shot. He is world famous. He would shock me if he was ever in general population. So you're dealing with a different path and road than the ordinary inmate would experience in a medium or a maximum security prison. So that is a big factor. So just dealing with the fact that he may be in protective custody, I mean, now he's currently in a hospital unit, he has pre-existing medical conditions, makes this, you know, incredibly different than just dealing with your ordinary client. And we are in the post-Jeffrey Epstein era right now. The Department of Corrections doesn't want anyone dying on their watch. They're not rooting for people to get sick and die. This is a totally different sort of journey and path as a result of his fame, as a result of his age, as a result of his medical, as a result of having to protect him. This is a project for the Department of Corrections. They have a lot on their plate.
Not being in Gen Pop. So what would his special protective custody, what's the general term for that?
Adult Protective Custody Units, APCU is a common term, or just protective custody.
Is it better or worse to be, because I think a lot of people heard, oh, he's not in the general population, he's in protective custody. People are driven by the fact that they generally hate Harvey Weinstein. But people Correct. Said, oh, that's unfair, he's getting off better. What's your assessment? Is it better to be in one or the other?
No one's getting off better, right? I mean, anyone who says he's getting off better, you know, why don't they volunteer to go spend some time in a super maximum security prison? I mean, you're in prison. That's it. You lost your freedom. Okay, you don't get to choose. You get told what to do every single day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can't even do things you need to do, like go to the bathroom when you want to go to the bathroom. So there's no special treatment. You know, this notion that because he's in a regional medical unit means he's better off. So what are you saying? You'd rather be disabled and have spinal stenosis and have had a heart procedure? I mean, that's what you call special treatment. And protective custody, you're still in a jail cell. I mean, it's not like, you know, this is the Four Seasons. He's just in a different wing where there's a lot higher and tighter security. But it's not like he's got a better jail cell and extra accommodations and the food is better. That's just people being salacious and wanting to, you know, sell papers. That's all it is.
Will he have fewer interactions with other inmates there? The part of where people called you Google and there seemed to be some bonding, will that be afforded to him, that chance?
that opportunity is afforded to everyone. It'll just be afforded to him with a much lower number of people. General population, by its nature, means that you are exposed to a much greater degree of inmates and interaction. And granted, it's very different in medium security than max. Maximum security prisons, you're in a cell. They don't necessarily have day rooms where you can congregate. In mediums, you can congregate. In the maximum, you're congregating is either at your vocation, your job, or in the yard. If you're in protective custody, the amount of people that are in protective custody is, you know, 90% less. And if you're in a hospital, it's 98% less. So yes, he'll have the opportunity to speak with other people, but not at the degree or numbers that he would if he was in general population.
Were his questions and concerns to you different from what your other clients would ask you and be concerned about?
Many of them were the same. What is it like? People want to know about the bus ride. I often call it the first 90 days. What is it like to be powerless and have that feeling of loneliness? How do you get on the phones? How do you get commissary? You know, can you send emails, which now you can, in the Department of Corrections? What about clothing? What about books? He had all the same questions that everybody else did. As is well documented, as well known, Mr. Weinstein maintains his innocence. There's an appeal that's been filed. So there will be an appeal process in New York State. There is pending litigation in LA, all which is known. So he has a higher degree of legal needs than my other clients do, because he still has open and ongoing litigation. So that needs to be addressed, because being able to talk to your lawyers is a fundamental right. But getting phone time is not, you're afforded phone time, but that's not necessarily a fundamental right. So, you know, that's a very specific thing that we've needed to deal with.
When he asked about powerlessness, yes, I mean, look at you. You were doing well on Wall Street and quote unquote on top of the world, or at least doing well on Wall Street. And I'm sure some of your other clients had different degrees of power, but this is Harvey Weinstein and his degree of power is somewhat hard to fathom. How did you answer his question?
Brutal honesty, blunt honesty. And the first time I met him, and, you know, he's been very good to me. We have a very respectful relationship. I said, Mr. Weinstein, if you want me to tell you what you want to hear, it has been an incredible honor to meet you. I'm going to shake your hand and I'm going to walk right out the door, because I am never going to be the guy that's going to tell you what you want to hear. I'm going to tell you what you need to hear, and you're not going to like it a whole lot of times. And that's been the nature of our relationship. And sometimes I have to say things, you know, a couple of times. It's a very dark place. You really lose all your power. And yes, certainly he achieved power and prestige and success at a level that you and I will probably never know. So anyone who's gone through it all ends up kind of at the same bottom. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult for anybody.
You talk to your clients while they're in prison. Have you talked to him since he's been behind bars?
Yes.
And it's been reported he was diagnosed with coronavirus. Do you know how he's doing with that?
So, you know, we issued a statement, and I'm sure you, like everybody else, has been incredibly respectful. It's amazing. I got literally no follow-up calls when his press secretary, myself, and Arthur Idala issued a statement. And besides the fact that we would want to protect his privacy and his health condition privacy, you know, due to HIPAA laws, we can't comment on that. So we can neither confirm nor deny that he did or did not have COVID-19.
Yeah.
I want to point out that the Department of Corrections never said that he had COVID-19. The people that were reporting he had it were part of the Corrections Officers Union. Mm-hmm. So neither his legal defense team, of which I'm a part, or the Department of Corrections has ever said that he's had it. That all being said, he's in very poor health, but he's in as good of poor health as he can be in right now. That's all. You know, he's being monitored every single day. He did have a heart operation at Bellevue. That's true. His medical issues are documented, and, you know, there's a reason he's in a hospital.
From your conversations with him, does he reflect to you that what you guys talked about is more or less what's been coming to pass?
Yes. He knew. He had heard it enough from me. And, you know, even if he has to hear it once or twice on a call, which is not about him, it's anyone. It's hard to process in there, Mike. I mean, wake up and you're like, where am I? This is like the Bermuda Triangle. It's brutal. So yes, he understands and he comprehends.
Not about Harvey, but just in general, are you, your clients, very worried about how the correctional system is going to handle the coronavirus?
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is we're worried about the coronavirus. I think it's unfair to pin it on the correctional facility and more than it would be to pin it on anyone else. Mm-hmm. I'm stunned that something like this hasn't happened in the prison systems already, whether it's COVID or some other pandemic or epidemic. Very worried. I don't use this word loosely or often. It'll be a miracle if there aren't thousands of deaths inside the New York State prison system from COVID-19. None of that because of the Department of Corrections, just the setup. You're confined, it's prison, they're old, it's a petri dish. They don't have the proper sanitizing soap access.
For instance, during flu season, it hit prisons hard.
Yeah, people get sick all the time, but it doesn't need to be flu system. I mean, people getting sick in the middle of the summer was 75 degrees. I mean, Forget about social distancing before it even became a thing. I mean, people just cough on foods. I mean, you don't know what anyone's doing. You know, you don't know if people just come in and wiping their germs on your locker. I mean, it's a horrible, disgusting place, Mike. And which is why it's incredible that something like this hasn't really ripped through the prison system before. So the feds are reporting numbers more freely. I'm not saying what's right or wrong here, but again, I think it'll be a miracle if, you know, 1,000 people or more don't die inside the New York State Department of Corrections.
In some ways, you're the best person to ask. And in some ways, maybe you have your own motivations, but I want to ask you if you think Rikers should be shut down.
Oh yeah. Rikers needs to be shut down. Yeah. I say that just from a humanity standpoint.
Well, why is it so much worse? There probably in the current system has to be that sort of transitional facility where people are near New York City and before they go upstate. So what about Rikers makes it so terrible?
No particular order. It's completely unsanitary and unhealthy. It's ripe for all sorts of disease and infection. That's one reason it needs to be shut down. I mean, there are cracks in the walls and the floor. There's flooding all over the place, which further makes it unsanitary. Mice run freely in the dorms. Mice feces are all over the place. There's the sanitary situation with bathrooms is non-existent. Just the way it's all set up is ripe for violence. I mean, the amount of violence that goes on in there and corruption that goes on there could be limited in an alternate facility. It's barbaric, Mike. It is truly barbaric being in there. And if you get 1 hour of sunlight a day, that's it. That's the most you can get. There's no gym facilities. There's no rec facilities. It's cruel and unusual punishment by every definition of how you can define it.
Last question. Having your background, how have you been dealing with quarantine?
Better than most,
I would think.
Assume. Yeah. I mean, I say it a lot. I mean, it's all perspective. I mean, Mike, it takes a lot to get me going. When you sleep next to someone who has a shiv under their bed, it's very different. Look, I'm no different than anyone else. I mean, I get a little jumpy sometimes. I have taken walks to Central Park just to get fresh air. But I know how to live life a day at a time. I know how to live life an hour at a time. I know how to chunk my time and goalpost my time. And so while I don't recommend it to anybody going to prison, while it certainly wasn't on my original bucket list, it has provided me an opportunity to change as a human being in ways that I wouldn't have changed. And it's provided me with life skills that I wouldn't have ordinarily had.
Craig Rothfeld is the founder, proprietor of Inside Outside LTD, a prison consulting service. Craig, thanks. Oh, I wonder if this takes on a different valence, but thanks so much for your time.
I like that. It's time on the outside. It's free time. You're welcome. You know, I'll close you with this. About the time, like when I went to visit him at Bellevue, the favorite thing I got to say to the guards was, I'm fine as long as the gates open and I can walk back out. So you're very welcome.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season 1, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
And now the spiel. Augustin Sandoval was a dope dealer, according to the New York Daily News, and a murderer, according to the New York court system. He was tried and convicted in the early 1970s. I could not find much else on the actual Augustin Sandoval. There is an Augustin Sandoval who's a world-class trumpeter from Mexico. That's not our guy. There's another Augustin Sandoval who was a Spanish gymnast who participated in the 1972 Olympics. Also not our Augustin Sandoval. Despite the dearth of biographical data on the Augustin Sandoval in question, there is an extensive record in the New York State legal system about our particular Augustin Sandoval. And at his murder trial, the prosecution was keen to let the jury know most of it. They wanted to introduce evidence about a 1960 charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, 1963 and 1965 convictions of driving while intoxicated, 1965 arrests for felonious assault resulting in dismissal, a 1965 traffic violation, and a 1967 charge of gambling. But the court would not allow those charges, those crimes, sometimes those convictions, to be relayed to the jury. The court, however, did allow some of Sandoval's convictions, such as the 1964 disorderly conduct and the 65 conviction of assault in the third degree. And they also decreed that the prosecution could inquire as to the underlying facts with respect to either of those conditions. The issue was, as the court put it, a balance between the probative value of such proof and the danger of prejudice when it is presented to the accused. In other words, a lot of misdeeds in the past, they could have just shown that Sandoval was a bad dude, not the particular good or bad dude who did this particular crime. The courts did not want to allow irrelevant information which just besmirched his characters. But they did say if it was a series of acts which did a couple of things, like establish a scheme that applied directly to what the jury was being asked about, then that might be allowed. This all literally came up, I think it was 3 days ago in the Trump trial. Could they allow? They had a Sandoval hearing. This is what happens in New York criminal courts. Would they allow past, in Trump's case, civil convictions? And then they decide what could be cross-examined related to those civil convictions. And that is now, this entire question is the crux for overturning the Weinstein verdict. Ready? I say it's good that it was overturned. Good? How good? Why good? Weinstein's a rapist, is he not? He is. And I say this, as I said in the top of the show, not in just the common understanding of the sense. I commonly understand, because I read a lot about him, probably so did you, that he was a sexual harasser, and I think he was a rapist. There's a lot of evidence that he was a rapist. That's how we decide on things in the world. We look at the evidence, and we try to decide if the evidence convinces us. And then once we're convinced, we say, yeah, I think this thing happened. So that applies to Harvey Weinstein. I think he's a rapist. But put all that aside, he's also convicted in Los Angeles, in California. A trial there found him guilty of three charges, including rape. So you don't have to go through the whole metaphysical definition of what is. Sometimes for a principle to be upheld in the general, however, a specific defendant has to go free. And we don't like that. We don't like for the innocent to be jailed, but we don't like for the guilty to go free. It challenges our sense of justice. It is literally an injustice in the specific, even though if we're pursuing justice in the general. I bet that it's very hard for Weinstein's victims, not just the ones who testified, not just the ones for whom he was found to have raped, but all his victims, his many victims, to hear this verdict, to have to deal with the ordeal of public exposure to all the women who testified at the trial, to have to go through that, and then ultimately to be told, yeah, we shouldn't have let you testify in the first place. But like I said, in this case, Harvey Weinstein does remain behind bars. California state law rests on similar general principles, but is different in terminology. In New York, witnesses who testify about similar crimes, but not the exact crime, those are called Molyneux witnesses. And what could be admitted if a defendant cross-examines those witnesses is subject to the Sandoval rule. So I asked you to think beyond the specific case of Harvey Weinstein, because Harvey Weinstein was a bad guy. We know he raped, we know he assaulted many women, and we know this because there was more investigative journalism and quite a bit of jurisprudence spent on him, maybe more so than any non-murderer, I don't know, ever. I include in this Bill Cosby. I include in this just about everyone accused of financial wrongdoing. Weinstein was, after all, the most powerful man in Hollywood, which is the most paid attention to business in America. And undoing him yielded not just news articles and books, but feature films and many, many nonfiction films. So what I'm saying is it's so thoroughly documented that he harassed and assaulted many women. That's not a question. And if it were a question, many courts have decided and ruled on it that he did this. Okay. Don't think of Harvey Weinstein. Think of a typical defendant. You know nothing about this guy. There was never a documentary, never even an article in the newspaper. So this guy goes before a judge, a jury, the system, and it's not arrayed in his favor. I say a criminally charged individual deserves exceedingly rigorous standards when it comes to introducing evidence of other crimes, not the one he's charged with, which could besmirch his character. They have the rules about this. I don't think it should never be done. It's not about what I think. It's about applying the Sandoval rules, and other courts have other standards. But in general, we should not convict people for being bad people. We should convict them for doing bad illegal deeds. But if prosecutors are allowed to introduce evidence which convinces jurors who are human that the person before them is so obviously a bad person, it gives jurors a massive amount of leeway to find the person guilty, not because of the crime, but because of the person. They might figure, and they might do this subconsciously, look, even if we're wrong, how bad a mistake are we making? Look at all these other crimes. Look at all these other misdeeds. We would be doing our neighborhoods, our community, our society a favor. But it's not how the criminal justice system is supposed to work. And a ruling like Weinstein's successful appeal makes certain that this tantalizing prospect available to prosecutors is not abused. And when it is abused, the entire question, the proper adjudication of guilt or innocence, is also abused. I gotta say, I was a little surprised by this decision because while I thought I followed Weinstein's trial pretty carefully, I guess I didn't follow it carefully enough when there was a debate about allowing these women to testify. Or if there was a debate, maybe the coverage never put their finger and therefore my consciousness on how questionable a decision it was. I was under the impression that the courts had Weinstein, if not dead to rights, then pretty close. But today, the New York Times' Jody Cantor wrote a story titled, Harvey Weinstein's Conviction Was Fragile from the Start. Now, I was wondering, does she mean fragile in that it's very hard to convict a powerful person on years-old evidence that could come down to he said, she said? Okay, I get that sort of fragility. Cantor and Megan Toohey, her writing partner on this series, emphasized that over and over again. Or was she saying that the fragility was exactly what the court put its finger on, the use of these particular witnesses? I never got that impression at all. Outside the courthouse, when the trial began, Cantor's co-author of the series, an eventual book that became She Said, Megan Toohey, was interviewed by Dasha Burns of NBC. And in Toohey's analysis, the fragility was more a question of would the courts be stalwart enough to meet the social moment?
I mean, as much as the Me Too movement has been durable, the endurance of the fear and pressure that women feel is almost as significant. I mean, there are still women, even in the Harvey Weinstein's case, who are afraid to come forward. That is also quite a lasting effect. What does that say about how much is left in this battle?
I think that it's clear that, you know, going into 2020, in terms of the Me Too movement, it feels like everything has changed and nothing has changed at the same time. There have been obviously an unprecedented number of women who have come forward with their stories of sexual harassment and abuse. It really feels like there's been a cultural shift. At the same time, there are questions about whether or not there's really systemically anything has changed. And I think that this is going to be a chance to see how the criminal justice stacks up within this Me Too moment.
The answer, almost 4 years to the day since his conviction, appeared to have been yes. But now, well, it's still yes if you define justice as a bad man getting his due, Harvey Weinstein's still in prison. If you define it as properly adhering to procedure in which every criminal defendant deserves, the New York Appeals Court, by only a 4-3 margin, said it wasn't a just verdict. And if you were surprised that the trial judge's rulings were found to be on shaky or illegitimate legal ground, I was surprised too. So I went back to see if journalists, if any experts, were contemporaneously questioning the Sandoval rulings, the ability of prior bad act witnesses to be heard from. I found a write-up in The Nation magazine by Joanne Wipicheski, and she wrote, "The media largely characterized the defense argument as an attack on women and sidestepped the vital matter of whether the prosecution had proved its case." She goes on to highlight exactly the prior bad act witnesses, and she also chastises the media for not seeing what she was seeing. Wipicheski took issue with more than just the Sandoval rulings, but her contemporaneous write-up of the trial, which was filed before the verdict, comports with what I'm now beginning to understand really happened. That the entire media narrative can be heard in how Dasha Burns framed her first question to Megan Toohey as the trial started.
What have you seen about how difficult it is to navigate a case like this and to get justice?
Now that's what you asked before a war crimes trial against Milosevic, not an American criminal case which might maybe properly hinge on issue other than the bravery of the victims. And I do think the victims were brave, and I do think the victims were victims. But as with so much else in this country, the moral and ethical issues of Weinstein were flattened to how good we are to have finally caught a monster. And when that's the issue, when shortcuts are not just downplayed, they're not even observed, it's bad for the overall quest for justice. There was a moment when someone could have said, you know, there are some issues here that reverberate beyond Weinstein, that even reverberate beyond this one movement. Less than rigorous application of the principle of when to allow Molyneux witnesses, which are these prior act witnesses, if you're not careful about that, you are committing a literal injustice. And to their credits, the court saw this, I think more than the media did. I'll quote an AP article covering the appeals hearing. This was back in February. Judge Jenny Rivera wondered if the behavior the women described clearly met the high legal bar for allowing additional accusers to take the stand, nearly that their testimony is evidence of the same motive, opportunity, intent, or a common scheme or plan. And Betsy Barrows, who was on the Court of Appeals, appeared alarmed by the judge's ruling allowing prosecutors to confront Weinstein about unrelated behavior. She asked, "How is this a fair trial when you're not able to put in your side of it?" Well, it wasn't a fair trial, and the courts eventually got that right. And the news ran right past that. And justice, defined as something a little grander than finding this defendant guilty or validating this movement, justice, don't worry, we'll get another chance. Prosecutors say they're putting Weinstein back on trial. Also, next month in California, Weinstein's lawyers are set to appeal that verdict. And that's it. Come and join us again on Monday. I want to thank my producer, Corey Warr, my senior producer, Joel Patterson. And as always, Monday will breathe new life into this endeavor. Thank you so much. Talk to you then.